You may remember that this morning I described a situation as follows. I'm talking to you, and you understand what my words mean. Situation A. Situation B is, taking situation A as a whole, my talking to you and you understanding what I mean, what does that situation mean? And we find it doesn't mean anything. This could be a way, when we say something is meaningless, it's a way of putting it down. But on the other hand, when you consider a mountain, or a cloud, or a tree, and ask, what does it mean? And you realize it's not a word, it's simply an authentic existence in its own right. It doesn't mean anything, but it's great. And so, in this way, the nearest thing in that kind of achievement that nature does all the time in human activities is music. Once when Gustav Holst was giving a lecture on music, he started out this way. He said, music is a natural and universal language. He took a step backwards and said, that's so important I'm going to say it again. Music is a natural and universal language. But nobody knows what it's about. Sometimes we say music represents emotions. But a great deal of music, although it has a very strong feeling quality, does not represent specific emotions. Inferior music copies natural noises. The sound of water, the thunder of the hooves of horses, or in that dreadful composition, the 1812 Overture of Tchaikovsky, you hear Napoleon's armies retreating from Moscow. Or in some of the bad work of Debussy, like La Cathédrale Engloutie, you makes noises like bells tolling from under the water. But our very great musicians of the West, Bach, Scarlatti, Mozart, and so on, they don't do anything with the music except create elaborate patterns of sound. Bach is very mathematical, and yet, curiously, despite his tremendously developed intellect, the music has a very strong feeling quality, joyous and exuberant. But it's all pure play with sound. And therefore, one might say, the communication that you make with music is, in a curious way, the most important kind of communication you can make, even though you're saying nothing. The music delivers no information, but what a form of communication. And so it is also with dancing with somebody. All you are saying with dancing is, I love you, if you're delivering any message at all. I want to play with you. All I really want to do is, baby, be friends with you. What does it mean? What is the content of friendship? You can't say. What is the content of love? I want to screw you. That's a sort of, it's part of it, it's incidental, it's a way of saying very strongly, yes, I do want to be with you. But basically, love is something we can't put our finger on at all. We say, we use such words as warmth, tenderness, all these things, they don't really get to the point. When you're loving somebody, you are simply delighting in that person as such, as if another human organism, in its mental and its physical aspects, were a piece of music, or a work of art, or a glorious morning, that you were just enjoying every inch of it. And you go over another person's physical form, and look at it from every possible point of view, and play with it, and tickle it. And that's what it's about. It's the adoration of the form of a human being. And you do that adoring in terms of physical contacts that are, say, dancing with your fingers across the skin, or whatever it may be. But this is the nitty-gritty, the nub of love. It is not that I here and now solemnly undertake to support you for the rest of your life. That's a delusion of the West. You think you don't really love me unless you will sign on the dotted line here and give me this contract. And then I know I can rely on you always. What did you want it for? Why did you want the contract? Just to be fed indefinitely? Just to be supported indefinitely? What a bore. One wants something much more than that. You want to be played with indefinitely. That's more like it. To have this vibrancy going through you. And this then is why music of all the arts is the most meaningless art. After all, music is a major industry in the United States. The money invested in orchestras, in operas, in the recording business is fantastic. Horse racing is a very great industry, but music, I think, is probably absorbs more millions than horse racing. And you could make a case that this was a complete dissipation. It solves no useful purpose. It doesn't help anyone to survive. It is a noise, meaningless noise, endless meaningless noise going down the drain. And all these energies of orchestras, all the power of electronics that delivers this, is total waste. And people get hooked on it. They get a thing called chorditis, which is addiction to harmonics. And they have to have this repeated, day after day. Some people get up in the morning and they can't function till they've had a cup of coffee. But many more people get up in the morning and can't function till they've turned on the radio and got some music. Now what would you say then of a culture which took this standpoint? Music not allowed. Music is a diversion from reality. You know, that kind of awful utilitarian attitude. But really, one of the basic things, you see, that we live for. What makes it worth surviving and going on is there can be such a thing as music. There can be dancing. In other words, that we can do things that are absolutely irrelevant so far as mere survival is concerned. Now we have the proverb that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Dull for work. And people who play, justifying their play by making it a means to that end, those people never play. Because you don't really play until you get so absorbed in the music or the dancing or the whatever, the making the part or doing the calligraphy, until you get so absorbed in it that there is no reason for it other than what you're doing. The sheer delight of that. Then, because you are absorbed in something for which there is no ulterior motive and which is pure play, this, by way of a byproduct, produces sanity. In other words, if you play in order to be healthy, in order to be sane, you are not playing. But if you play just to play, then as a byproduct, as something you couldn't aim at directly, you are sane. And so a culture which allows for this, which allows for this sort of goofing, is a healthy culture. This is not the culture that we live in, because it is extremely anxious about play. Everybody, when they play, they have to find an excuse for it. They say, well, this is culture. You try and persuade the city of San Francisco to support its opera. What sort of propaganda do you have to use? You can't say, we should have a good opera house here because we dislike going to the opera. Say, this improves the city's image. After all, they have it in New York. And that is because we do not allow ourselves the idea that life is not serious. Because somehow you feel if you aren't engaged in something serious, you're a loafer. You're not contributing to the social welfare. And so in this way, the artist has a peculiar role in this society. Very, very interesting. Because the artist is a very deceptive fellow. He appears to be the supreme luxury, the irrelevant fellow. You can afford an artist. You can afford to buy paintings if you have surplus money. And that's a luxury. So you can support an artist. And we call it fine arts. The completely useless person who makes paintings, which are sort of big labels or posters that you stick on your utilitarian walls to decorate them. But on the other hand, the artist is the man who shows you the future long before everybody else sees it. The artist is the eye-opener. Just because the artist is distinct in role from the preacher and the philosopher, the artist can get away with all sorts of things. For example, in our culture, if you're a university professor, a doctor, or a minister, take these three professions, teacher, doctor, minister, you have to be very careful about your private life. Because the moment you have any alliances that are not quite regular, people's tongues begin to wag. And why do they wag? Because they say the way you behave is inconsistent with your profession, with what you profess. You are teaching people the good life, the healthy life, and you live in this disreputable way. You have a mistress, you have something or other going on. But the moment an artist should take a mistress, this is what is expected of him. Everybody says, oh, he's an artist. In other words, he doesn't matter. He's irrelevant. He's an entertainer, some sort of clown. But on the other hand, if you belong to high culture, you patronize artists. See? So the role of the artist is very fascinating because he appears to be the clown, the jester, the absolutely unimportant and irrelevant person. And yet it's actually through the artist that we learn how to live. Not through the preacher, not through the philosopher, not through the professor. It is the artist teaches us, whether he does it visually, with painting, or on sculpture, tactually, or whether he, above all, in music. So a man like Mozart, who could well claim to be the greatest man in European history, was a kind of a gay, happy-go-lucky fellow with problems, money, illness, etc. But what a songbird, what a nightingale. And so then to this day, listening to Mozart is in England, the Glyndebourne Opera, this is about the farthest out fashionable, aristocratic thing you can do. To go to this lovely country house in Sussex and hear the Mozart operas. It's as much a matter of status as going to church. Almost more so. You should read, if you can get hold of it, an interview with George Harrison, one of the Beatles, in a recent issue of the East Village Other, where he explains the deep philosophy of music that they understand and follow. How the very nature of sound reveals the meaning of the world. And why? Because of this, he regards himself as a Hindu. In Hinduism, the fundamental source of life is called vak. Vak in Sanskrit means the word, to speak. But not so much the word that communicates as the sound, the utterance, the flow of tone. So you have in India the use of mantra, the use of chanted words as one of the very basic forms of yoga, understanding the mystery of the world. The Hindus use the word Om, which would be spelled out A-U-M, because the letter A, A, is in the back of the throat. You push it through the vowel to Aum, and M is at the lips. So the word Om comprehends the whole range of sound. It's called the pranava. And Om simply means, well, it is the sound. All sounds are basically the sound Om, but varied. The word that not only signifies, but also is what there is. Everything is Om. Om, sweet Om. The whole universe is Om. And so this is a very good word, because you can use it instead of God. God has all sorts of nasty associations attached to it. The political boss of the world, the preacher, the prig, the nosy Parker in charge of everything, the rotten grandfather, and all that, the sentimental mother of the world, or whatever it is. And the word God, therefore, is a distasteful word now to most Westerners. But Om has no associations with it. You might have encountered it in a Vedanta society and associated with Swamis in yellow robes or something. But on the whole, Om has no association. And so it is a clean word, and it has no meaning, except it is the very pulse of life. And so I'm spreading a rumor. In Buddhism, you know, there is a mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And Om means nothing, except everything. Mani means a jewel. Padma is a lotus. Hum is hooray, you know? So the jewel and the lotus. In other words, imagine a mandala, you see, which is a lotus flower, with all those petals spreading out from it. And right bang in the middle of that, there is a little crystal ball, or a diamond. And you look into that, and it contains the reflection of everything in it, you see? You go way, way, way into that thing, down, 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 you know? And that's the ultimate turn-on. So, Om, and at the end, Hum, or H-U-M. You can say Hum in English, Hum. Hum, you hum. There's a new religion existing called Hum. And this religion has no hierarchy, no organization, no doctrines whatsoever. No words. Only music and ritual. And we will find in a little while that Hum is really what most people belong to. And but you can't pin it down. There is no address to write to. There's nothing to join. It's just something that people do, like they shave and brush their teeth and eat breakfast. So they hum. Well, now, it's very, very fascinating for purposes of understanding music as communication to look for a moment at different fundamental differences between Western and Oriental music. I know a very, very great musicologist who thoroughly understands the world of Bach and Beethoven. and is one of the greatest scholars in music I've ever run into. But when to his ear, Hindu music is childish, and he sees no subtlety in it, he's quite deaf. But when it comes to Chinese and Japanese music, most Westerners are flabbergasted. They can't make any sense of it at all, because it sounds as if somebody were making the most ridiculous noises. So when it was a Japanese no drama singer comes on. We think he's sounding as if he's being strangled. But he's giving sounds of passionate love. See? But to our ears, that's deplorable. You know, when we want to give examples of love. Etc., you know? We really have said we're in love. Well, now, here is the thing. In Western music, when we study music, the first thing we learn is notation. We have, most people begin with the piano, or at any rate some instrument, where the important thing is to be able to read the music and then do the stuff from the written paper. Now this limits you in a curious way, because our notation, first of all, is based on the chromatic scale. And secondly, it has fixed rhythmic intervals. You see your whole note, half note, quarter note, eighth note, sixteenth note. And you can change the value by dotting them to give them half their value. And you tend to write in bars, 4-4 time, 3-8, or whatever it may be. And when an Oriental listens to our music, it doesn't matter whether it's a love song or a grandiose paean of praise or whatever. All of it sounds like a military march, because it's that 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, or 1-2-3-4-5-6, 1-2-3-4-5-6, 1-2-3-4-5-6. Here's this. All the time. And he hears a mechanism in it. You see, he hears this absolute regularity. Now, in Indian music, you'll have bars, very long measure, you can count 20 to the bar, times more. And when you learn music from an Hindu teacher, you don't learn notation. You learn directly from the teacher. In other words, he takes the instrument and plays it, and you copy him with the same instrument sitting in front of him. And they think, you see, that notation could never record music. They do use a notation. They use a notation to remember simply themes. There is a certain rag, a certain theme, and they can write that down. But they don't play from it. What they do is they, according to certain traditional procedures, they improvise on the basic forms, and you therefore play the instrument. And what you're trying to do is to make it as completely as possible responsive to the subtle motions of which a human organism is capable. In other words, just as in moving your hand, there's an infinity of waves you can put it through. So likewise, in using your voice, there is an infinity of sound that you can produce. Because the same you can with a stringed instrument, in moving your finger, where there are no rigid stops as there would be on a piano. So on the continuum of a violin, you can move your finger and produce an infinity of subtle sound. And what they do is they delight in the infinite possibility of making sound with the human organism, And they like instruments which are very easily and directly related to the organism. So the flute, the veena, the drums. See, these are direct human contact with an instrument. With a piano, you've got something interspersed. You've got a hammer mechanism. And a rigidly tuned string. With a harpsichord, the same way, the pluck. And when Wanda Landowska, marvelous as she is, plays the harpsichord, you get a hurdy-gurdy effect. Clickety-clickety-click, clop-clop-clop-clop, clickety-click, clop-clop, chickety-chick-chick-chick, clop-clop, clickety-click-click-click-click. You hear this going on all the time. With a clavichord, there is a difference, because the clavichord doesn't have a mechanical relationship between the finger and the string, so that by every variation of touch you make on a clavichord is represented in the sound. In other words, the piano and the harpsichord are like electric typewriters, which have a uniform touch, whereas the clavichord is more like an old-fashioned typewriter, where however hard you hit has some effect on the print. So, in Oriental music, then, while there is an incredibly subtle discipline, and a Hindu drummer can do the most astounding things, and you can count it out, he counts it out in these very, very elaborate patterns. But at the same time, there is an attitude about it that's just fascinating. We attended a concert at the De Young Museum a few weeks ago, where there was Ali Akbar Khan's orchestra. And there was a drummer in this who was just out of this world. And the wonderful thing about it was that as he was playing with the rest of the orchestra, they were all talking to each other with their instruments. And they made eye contact while they were playing. And this guy was just in sheer delight. He was laughing as he was playing. And all the other musicians were just loving it. So that he wasn't this dead, earnest person looking at his music, you know, and reading that and doing it. He was joining in with everybody, dancing with them. His fingers were like butterflies, hummingbirds, better to say, just vibrating in the most extraordinary way. Because it takes years and years and years to learn this. But he was really enjoying it. But what was he saying? They have a language for the drums, and they can speak a drum rhythm by using syllables like dit, di, dit, da, dit, di, dit, da, or din, meaning one kind of a hit, and din and thin. Din, tin, din, tin, din, tin, din, tin, din, 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 you know? And they explain a rhythm like this sometimes first. They say it, and then they play it. But it's all, what's all about? It's all about dit-da. Dit-da.